Welcome to another episode of Out the Rabbit Hole here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and on the web at KUCI.org. It's 3:04 on our Friday afternoon, March 17th, 2006. I'm Robert Larson. We live in truly strange times where the most bizarre, unsubstantiated stories are being passed off as reality by our government and the corporate news media. One of the more outrageous examples of this is the quote-unquote official story of what happened on September 11th, 2001, and how it happened. My guest today on the line from the UK was one of the first people to seriously question that strained narrative. He is Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, and we will be discussing his recent book, The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism, which is a sequel to his earlier book, The War on Freedom. Mr. Ahmed is executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in Brighton, UK. Welcome to the show, Nafees.
Hi there, Robert.
It's good to have you. How are things today over across the ocean there?
Things are, as you would expect with everything that's been going on. But we're still reeling from the London bombings, so it's happening everywhere, really.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the group. You are the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development.
Yeah.
What do you guys do?
Well, basically, we're kind of an interdisciplinary think tank. We do research on mostly to do with trying to analyze social problems and global crises in an integrated way. So we're looking at a whole host of different issues, ecological crisis, political instability, military intervention, all these things. We're looking at them in a kind of holistic, interconnected way and trying to understand where these crises are coming from, how to offer a framework of solutions for dealing with them on a local and a global level. So that's really what we do. We have a network of academics and researchers, kind of an ad hoc network all over the place, who contribute things occasionally. People following their own lines of research, and we put it together on our website.
So, there's this growing 9/11 truth movement here in the U.S., where, and I believe your book, The War on Freedom, was the first publication. Well, when did you first start considering that something was seriously wrong with the official narrative being presented about 9/11? Were there things being put out over the news on that day that sort of put up red flags for you, or was this something that kind of came to you over time?
I fall in the second category. I've always been very kind of skeptical of things, but never to the point that I would actually suspect that the government might have actually participated or facilitated this kind of a terrorist attack on its own people. That idea would have been absolutely impossible for me to take. So on the events of 9/11 itself, I absolutely believed the official story. I swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. But it was about 1 or 2 months down the line, and I found a couple of interesting articles by one fellow, Michael C. Rupert, who is former LAPD narcotics detective, and he runs his From the Wilderness journal at the moment. He's looking at current affairs these days. But he did a couple of interesting investigations of insider trading before 9/11, which really pertained to extremely odd kinds of short selling on stocks related to companies involved in what happened on 9/11. So, for example, United Airlines, American Airlines, had huge short selling on them in the days prior to the attack, as well as companies who had offices in the World Trade Center. And it was pretty clear that there was something definitely going on. I mean, financial experts from around the world came out and said that there's clearly suspicious trading here, and the whole official investigation was launched. But what was most interesting about Rupert's research was that he disclosed he the former executive director of the CIA. I can't quite remember. I can't remember his name now. But I mean, this is quite a common thing in terms of the relationship between Wall Street and the intelligence services. It's like a revolving door. But this particular instance is very, very odd. And he actually had a journalist from his office call up the CIA press department and ask them that, you know, is the investigation into the official intelligence investigation into these trade, into this anomalous trading, does it include the connection of the former CIA executive director? And the spokesman on the other end of the line for the CIA said, no comment. So he didn't even deny, he didn't want to elaborate on what was going on. So clearly there was something going on there. And that set off alarm bells for me, mm-hmm. that perhaps the government really did know more than what was going on, and this really needs to be looked into. So I started digging. Another very influential figure for me was Michel Chossudovsky, the professor of economics mm-hmm. in Canada, who has been writing about al-Qaeda connections in the Balkans and how the United States, in particular, has had many links with these networks in the Balkans in order to pursue various interests in that region. These kind of things put together really showed to me that clearly the government hasn't been entirely open and honest about what happened on 9/11. And that was when I started looking much deeper into these things.
One of the best things you present in your book, The War on Truth, is this timeline for the morning of September 11th that you precisely document from all these different available sources. And I can't read that and not conclude, at the very least, serious criminal negligence on the part of the U.S. government at the highest levels. Could you go over that timeline with us?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a hugely complex and detailed thing when you start looking at all the different stories that have been put out and trying to analyze them together. But when you get down to it, it's actually quite simple. Because on the morning of that day, we had, within the space of about 20 minutes, four planes had been successively hijacked in the most restricted airspace in the world. Now, the important thing to understand in relation to this timeline is that this timeline of events is what happens, what are the standard procedures that are used by the U.S. military, by the Federal Aviation Administration to respond to the kind of emergencies that happened on 9/11. Now, when you break it down into its components, what happened on 9/11 was clearly that we had a plane which had a fixed flight path. You know, it's supposed to take off from one place, it has a destination which is recorded. It has a fixed flight path, which in exactly how it's going to get to its destination is mapped out in precise detail. And air traffic controllers are monitoring this consistently. As soon as a plane deviates from its flight path, standard procedures make it mandatory that air traffic control, the FAA, will basically establish contact with the pilot to find out what has gone on. Because obviously you can't have a situation where planes are just flying around in the skies willy-nilly. It's going to be absolute disaster. There needs to be very, very tight regulation. You can't allow anything to go wrong. So they will try and establish contact with the pilot. Now, at that point, two things can happen. Either the pilot is going to be able to respond and say, sorry, you know, there was an error of some kind and blah, 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 and they'll be able to resolve the situation verbally. Or the pilot won't respond, they won't be able to resolve it. Now, that the second situation is when things start to get more serious, and there could be any number of explanations for what happened. The pilot could have been injured. He could be ill. There could be a technical fault that has prevented the pilot from responding. There could be loss of radio, and obviously there's the worst case scenario that there could be a hijacking. But in either of these cases, the FAA procedures don't actually distinguish between, say, a hijacking and even say a loss of radio contact or something like that. it's very simple that if they don't know what is going on and they're not sure, and they can't resolve the situation verbally by talking to the pilot, they've got no other option but to immediately scramble military jets to go and intercept the aircraft. And the task of that military jet is literally to get as close as they can to the plane and find out what is going on. And they will literally get all the way up so they can see inside the window and see what the pilot is doing. And there's a number of that they can maneuver their wings in certain ways to send messages to the pilot if there's problems with radio and so on and so forth. They can even use multiple planes to force a plane into a different airspace, for example. All kinds of procedures are there. And these are all public record procedures. There's nothing secret about them. You can find them on the internet at the FAA website and so on and so forth. So once we understand that this is what the standard response is, and we have to bear in mind that this happens all the time in response to routine emergencies, not just in relation to terrorist incidents or hijackings. So, for example, in the year preceding 9/11, there was something like 67 scrambles nationwide in the United States responding in a timely manner to these kind of general day-to-day emergencies that occur and that air traffic control has to deal with. So this raises the question of what exactly did happen on 9/11 in relation to the standard procedures. Well, we know that these four planes were hijacked. Now, there are multiple explanations that coming out from official stories that have changed and shifted over time about what actually happened. So on the first story that emerged I think literally within 2 or 3 days after the attacks, we had government officials coming out from different parts of the government confirming on the record absolutely clearly that they had not scrambled any military aircraft at all in response to this emergency, in order to prevent the attacks until after the Pentagon was hit. That means that the Pentagon was hit about something like 9:20 or 9:27. I can't remember the exact time. But if you take the time when the first aircraft was hijacked until the Pentagon was hit, you're looking at about 1.5 hours, 1 hour, 20 minutes. That's mm-hmm. the kind of time span we're talking about here. In other words, what these officials are saying is that for 1 hour and 20 minutes, there was absolutely no response from the U.S. military to planes that had been hijacked, that were known to be hijacked as early as 8:14 a.m. in the morning, we now know, according to FAA sources. So this is absolutely bizarre. And confirmation like this came from people of such a high standing as General Richard Myers, who was acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on 9/11. And he said this in his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Only a couple of days after 9/11, so this was sworn testimony. This was something that is very difficult to just say that this is something that you might say off the cuff. What's interesting is that even people such as Dick Cheney confirmed the same thing. He came on MSNBC, I think on 15th September, saying much the same thing in an interview with Tim Russert. And again, in the Boston Globe, we have a General Mike Snyder from NORAD saying exactly the same thing, that he actually said 15 minutes after the Pentagon was hit, we decided to scramble aircraft. So this was a really, really damaging story. It was suggested that, well, it didn't suggest, it stated very decisively that standard procedures on the morning of 9/11 had simply dropped. They hadn't been adhered to in the slightest. Now, interestingly, about a week to 2 weeks, I think it was 2 weeks later, we had an official timeline released by NORAD saying that, well, actually, they had scrambled aircraft. And what is interesting is that there was no acknowledgement of any of the statements that had been made in the days after 9/11 from so many prominent people involved with the military response. Suddenly we had this timeline by NORAD, and they had spaced everything out very nicely and evenly to suggest that planes were scrambled, and the general impression was given my spokesman that they had that a real effort had been made to intercept these aircraft, but they simply hadn't had the time to do so. It simply wasn't possible. Now, a number of people of different persuasions decided to analyze the new timeline. And the timeline itself served to be incriminating in yet another way. Mm-hmm. There was a journalist from London who's very well known. He's written for The Times, George Samuli. He writes for a local, the New York Press, kind of alternative New York daily, I understand, or newspaper. I don't know if it's weekly or daily or what. But he wrote a column in the New York Press looking at this timeline. And he took the speeds of an F-15 and an F-16. Which were flying on that day, apparently in response to 9/11, and he simply just took the distances that they would have travelled from what was it, Otis Air Force Base and Langley Air Force Base to the target, and calculated the times. And in the end, it seemed to be that these aircraft were flying at about a third of their maximum speed. So clearly, this timeline didn't absolve authorities at all from the failure to do something about 9/11 in a proper way and in adherence to procedures. Why on earth were fighters scrambled when they weren't flying at their maximum speed in response to what was clearly the most unprecedented emergency in the history of the United States? Absolutely bizarre.
Let me cut in on that. This is Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Robert Larson speaking with Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed. We're discovering his book. We're discussing his book, The War on Truth, 9/11, Disinformation, and the Anatomy of Terrorism. So this timeline, the thing I want to make sure everybody gets clear here is that when there is a hijacking, there are standard operating procedures that are supposed to go into effect requiring no orders from any high official. It just happens automatically when a plane, doesn't even have to be a hijacking, when a plane goes off course, and within minutes, if they don't resolve it, fighter jets are scrambled and are to resolve the situation as quickly as possible. And so that didn't happen. Being that's supposed to happen automatically, you are left to think, was there an order given for that not to happen?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it really raises fundamental issues about what on earth happened to standard procedures, because standard procedures are always followed, and that's the whole point. The idea is that you have lower-level officials in positions in the FAA and the military who adhere to these procedures. As soon as something happens, they respond. There is no need to go and seek approval from the White House or any other senior government officials. This all occurs on a day-to-day basis at a civil level within these civilian, amongst the civilian and military agencies who do this thing on a day-to-day basis. It's nothing special. And when you look at what happened on 9/11, these procedures just weren't operating, clearly. On that day, they weren't functioning, and there must be an explanation for why that is. Now, if we look at the explanation of the 9/11 Commission, for example, it's just not satisfactory at all. In fact, the 9/11 Commission perhaps brings up even more incriminating explanations for what happened. Really, I mean, I've looked at some of the details of the timelines that the Commission gives, and apart from the huge inconsistencies within the timelines that they give within the report, there's contradictions between what the Commission's timeline is with what NORAD and FAA officials have repeatedly stated in the public record and even in their testimony to the 9/11 Commission, which are simply not acknowledged by the Commission report, and a whole host of other things. But specifically in relation, for example, to this whole narrative of the interception of the hijacked aircraft by military jets, again, they give a number of odd explanations for what happened. One of the explanations is that the planes that took off, I think it was either Otis or Langley, I can't remember, the planes that were scrambled were not given were given a generic scramble order without any kind of clear directive on precisely where they were supposed to go. And in fact, interestingly, this was corroborated by NORAD official in an interview with, I think it was aviation, one of these aviation journals, who basically said the same thing, that that something happened for some reason. The aircraft was scrambled without any orders at all, and this situation wasn't rectified, and there wasn't any explanation of that. Now, this doesn't make any sense, because it was very clear what was happening on that day. FAA were monitoring these aircraft clearly. Now, so what the commission does, in order to bypass this, they give a number of stories suggesting that somehow the FAA and NORAD had lost track of the hijacked aircraft at different times, and therefore got rather confused. They were searching frantically on their radar for missing aircraft, and when they turned up, it was too late to actually scramble jets in time. So when they scrambled the aircraft, the military jets, it was just too late. This is the kind of picture they want to give, but it just doesn't stand to scrutiny. For example, this is what they say about Flight 77. They say Flight 77 had disappeared off the radar for about 20 minutes, suddenly had turned up out of the blue. Right, it was like a spot on near in Washington D.C. or something, and clearly they realized that something was going to happen, so they realized, but it was too late. And this whole story of a missing aircraft that disappeared off the radars has been contradicted by multiple sources in the public record, from the FAA, from the Department of Defense, from NORAD, saying that they had monitored aircraft, they had monitored Flight 77 specifically all the way during its course towards the Pentagon. There was one moment, they say, these officials say, when they were unsure of where it had gone, and that lasted about 5 minutes or so. But they confirmed that they had relocated the aircraft long before it had actually got near its target, and they were monitoring it very closely. So we see here that this narrative the commission put forth to explain away the misdirection of military jets doesn't make any sense. In relation to Flight 77, for example, they say that because there was this issue of a plane disappearing, there was another blip on the radars, an inexplicable blip, which they believed to be Flight 11, which had already crashed into the World Trade Center. And they're saying that suddenly this Flight 11 blip, 15 minutes after it had already crashed into the World Trade Center, it was flying around, and they could see it in Baltimore, heading towards Baltimore. So they decided to scramble aircraft to sit between, to go towards Baltimore in order to intercept it, something to that effect. And in the end, they said that they basically stationed the aircraft over there, and that was why they didn't go to Washington, D.C. and actually go directly to the Pentagon, where they were exactly where the flight was headed. And this is, again, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. How can you have these phantom blips on a radar being invented as an excuse to justify this complete misdirection of military jets? And there's a whole host of anomalies like this which are brought up in the new narrative, which only incriminate further the officials who are fundamentally responsible for this response on 9/11.
It's just seems like this web of lies that seems to be a cover up. The question is, I mean, what exactly are they covering up? I mean, it seems like it's worse than just incompetence, because just incompetence doesn't seem to explain what happened and the way they are covering it up. I want to ask you something about, you have a quote in your book, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? This was supposedly a quote that Norman Mineta relayed to the 9/11 commission from Vice President Cheney minutes before the plane hit the Pentagon. So who was Cheney saying that to, and what was the context, and why is that particularly alarming?
Yeah, this was a very, very odd, because, I mean, this was about something like 9:20, 9:25 a.m., just a few minutes before the Pentagon had been hit. And the context of that statement was, Norman Mineta, Transport Secretary, had walked in to this underground bunker where Vice President Cheney was sitting there watching a screen, and one of his aides was apparently telling him, according to Mineta's testimony, that, you know, basically the flight is an aircraft getting closer and closer. It's in the proximity, and it's going to be here in about, what, something like 15 minutes. And every few minutes, he would basically update Cheney on the progress of this flight. So it was like 15 minutes, it's going to hit, it's going to be here, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. And I think at 5 minutes or something, I think either it was Mineta himself or somebody else, I think, but someone had asked Cheney, do the orders still stand? And Cheney apparently whipped his head around, according to Mineta, and said very firmly, of course they'd stand. And that was it. And then, the Pentagon was hit. This raises a lot of really, really odd questions, because it's Norman Mineta himself, when he related this, he seemed to assume that Cheney must have been talking about some kind of shoot-down order that had been in place in order to shoot down any of these hijacked aircraft. Now, the problem is that the 9/11 Commission report confirms itself, and a number of other sources confirm outside the Commission report independently, that the order to the shoot-down order had only been given by President Bush, received by Cheney, at about 10 a.m., and it was actually, to be honest, it was a few minutes after 10 a.m. So this could not have been the order that Dick Cheney was talking about. So what was he talking about? Now, there was an interesting article in Time magazine which said that the FAA chief, Jane Garvey, I think that's her name, she gave an order at something like, about a few minutes before 9:20 or something like that, I can't remember, but certainly a few minutes before, she had given a comprehensive order ordering a stand down on all planes in the United States. But this stand down was comprehensive, and the magazine article stated clearly that it included not only civilian planes, but law enforcement and military aircraft. In other words, that would include any military aircraft that ought to have responded in a timely fashion to this terrible, terrible sequence of events on 9/11. And these were the very aircraft that we needed by standard procedures to get into the skies as soon as they could. So this would suggest that the order that Cheney was talking about was this very FAA order that apparently, according to Time magazine, had been made in consultation with the White House. So Cheney was most probably in on this and fully aware that this is what he was talking about. And this obviously raises a lot of fundamental questions. That was there a stand-down order? Clearly, the evidence seems to suggest that there was some kind of a stand-down order preventing the procedures from being adhered to as they should have done. It also raised a number of other issues. That why was Cheney sitting there in the bunker waiting for 15 minutes for this plane to come closer towards the Pentagon, which was clearly its target, when he didn't request anybody to evacuate these buildings? The Pentagon could have been evacuated and hundreds of lives could have been saved. There should have been an evacuation order on the White House. But nothing like this happened. They waited for 15 minutes and they just sat there while this happened, and they maintained this order. So I think that this really just brings us, it really homes us in on what is the where we have the likely key individuals who are culpable on that day.
But the frustrating thing is that the 9/11 Commission, most of these things you're bringing up, they just either ignored, or the way they dealt with it was just completely illogical. So can you tell us a little about the 9/11 Commission and why it was almost an inevitability that they would bury the truth?
Well, the 9/11 Commission was really followed the principle of, when you have a really serious public relations crisis, you need to demonstrate to the public that well, we're really doing something about it. Because if you don't do that, you have a political problem on your hands. And one of the key ways of doing that here in England, so, you know, we Brits, we're really used to this, is the government sets up these inquiries, you know, basically skewers them in a direction which kind of generally gives a few criticisms, but generally fits within a very fixed agenda. And then they can carry on and say, look, we had the inquiry, everything's finished now. And this is really what the 9/11 Commission was about from the start. If we look at the fact that at the beginning they wanted to appoint someone like Henry Kissinger to chair this organization, I mean, I think many Americans were really perturbed by that, because they were quite aware of Kissinger's history in relation to covert operations, the CIA condoning human rights abuses in places like, you know, Pinochet's terrible abuses and so on and so forth. This is very well known. Apart from the fact that he eventually resigned, purportedly over the fact that he had conflicts of interest in relation to investments in Saudi Arabia and so on and so forth. But clearly, it was very, everybody knew that you're appointing Kissinger, this is basically a cover-up. People kind of were a bit more hopeful with the appointment of Thomas Keane to the commission. The problem is that the media, which kind of looked into some of Kissinger's conflicts of interest, didn't look at Keane's conflicts of interest or the conflicts of interest of any of the other members of the commission panel. Who were subsequently appointed. So we'll start with Thomas Keane, because I mean I can't remember all the details of every single panel member, because I mean there's so many. But Thomas Keane gives us a real example of how bad this is, because I mean Thomas Keane is a shareholder and director. Well, he was a shareholder and a director in this giant energy company, Amerada Hess, which is one of the world's biggest energy companies. Now Amerada Hess has a joint venture in the Caspian Sea with two major companies, Nimr Oil and Delta Oil, which are Saudi companies owned by two different Saudi families. And most perturbingly, the Bin Alamoudi clan and the Bin Mahfouz clan. The key figure of interest here in particular is Khalid Bin Mahfouz. Both of these families have been suspected by the U.S. government and investigated for the financing of international terrorism, particularly in relation to suspicion that they've been sending millions of dollars through kind of Islamist charitable fronts to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Specifically, Khalid bin Mahfouz has been investigated for much the same by the FBI. There was interest in him in relation to this Saudi Arabia. He was even named as a his name came up in a very very prominent lawsuit by the 9/11 families against the Saudi government and against a number of key Saudis, him being one of them, as again key financiers in Al-Qaeda. So the fact is that Thomas Keane effectively was a business partner of a suspected terrorist who suspected of being highly, highly involved in the financing of Al-Qaeda. And Bin Mahfouz has a very interesting history in this respect, it seems. There's been many, many reports of his dodgy involvement with the BCCI and, again, you know, arms dealing and terrorist financing that was going on there. So this is not something new. This is really the tip of the iceberg that we're seeing. Now, about after it was announced that Thomas Keane was going to be appointed, I think it was a month and a half or so before he actually took up his appointment with the commission, he left Amerada Hess. And this all happened very, very quietly. And nobody basically in the media raised the issue of the conflict of interest that Keane had, even worse, even more direct than anything Kissinger had in terms of conflict of interest. And yet he chaired this supposedly independent panel. Now, if we look at the other panel members of the commission, it's much the same. These people were connected to the airline industry. They had received money from different airlines involved in 9/11. They had served on various advisory panels for the government. in terms of intelligence and military policy. Many of them had been personal, very, very personally close to people in the government. For example, Zelikow is known to be a very, very close friend of Condoleezza Rice, and they had even co-wrote a book together. I can't remember the title, but that a couple of years ago, which just obviously illustrates the close nature of their ideology, their thinking, their policy making in general. So in other words, very clearly, the commission was set up to investigate what happened on 9/11, to look at the intelligence failures, but the very people who were carrying out the investigation were connected to the agencies, the industries, the interests that were supposed to be investigated. This was not an independent investigation at all. These people were virtually investigating themselves.
So that's why
we find that the commission consistently covered up things that would fundamentally damage and be very, very scandalous, embarrassing for the government.
So when people refer to it as a whitewash or a cover up, that you don't have a problem with that terminology?
No, absolutely. I think that it was very clear that this was an absolute whitewash and a very, very carefully orchestrated attempt to cover up the real facts about 9/11. And anyone who looks at the commission report and compares it to independent analyses of 9/11, such as mine, such as other authors, there's a very good, strong literature now, credible literature by different academics and journalists on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
That if you compare that literature to what is in the commission, it's a complete joke. I mean, it's literally like reading Alice in Wonderland. There's just absolutely nothing in there which stands up to meaningful scrutiny from the description of the hijackers as these radical Islamist fundamentalists, when we know that from eyewitness reports, that these guys were going to lap dancing clubs, were snorting cocaine and drinking alcohol. You know, you compare these kind of things to what they're telling us in the commission report, and you just think, this doesn't make any sense. Why is there this consistent, systematic desire to create this completely false picture of what happened? What are they trying to hide?
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned it's like Alice in Wonderland. That's why we call this show Out the Rabbit Hole. We try to pull people out of these false realities. And you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we're also on the web at kuci.org. This fascinating discussion is going on with Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed, and his book is The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism. I'm Robert Larson. And Mr. Ahmed, I also mentioned at the top of the show that you're the director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development. What's the website for that? You mentioned that?
This is www.globalresearch.org.
Okay, so people can go there and find more information regarding what we're talking about, and I would recommend you take a look at the book, too. And Interlink is the U.S. Publishing rep here for that book, The War on Truth. And I'd also like to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. Nafiz, you go so much into your book about the history of all of this, and we're not going to really have time to get into this today, but you know, I just really recommend people take a look at the book. But it's quite educational and informative for people to look at that and see how you show this going back at least 20 years, the connections between U.S. and Western intelligence in general, and quote-unquote terrorist organizations, and also how it ties in with the intelligence agencies of Pakistan, that the ISI, correct?
So this is
to really understand what's going on, people need to get into that and look at all of that. But I want to also just go over some of the things that actually happened on the day of 9/11, because I think that's a starting point for people. I think they need to first realize that just on that day alone, something doesn't add up, and then go back and look at the history. This is something I got to get into. The thing about the you recount in your book how in the the final commission hearing, an audience member was dragged out for shouting, "Tell us about the 9/11 war games." So what about these two weird-to-be-coincidence war games that the commission wouldn't examine?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is very interesting because it may provide... I mentioned the whole thing about this inexplicable blip appearing on a radar, this phantom plane that the commission talks about to explain why aircraft were basically sent to intercept a non-existent aircraft. and it's possible that this could be explained by the fact that there were multiple war games occurring on the morning of 9/11. And in the book, I think I document about six or seven of these intersecting military exercises. But actually, I mean, if listeners want to get further up-to-date information, I would strongly recommend www.cooperativeresearch.org, which is run by Paul Thompson, a good colleague of mine, who's also got a book on 9/11, The Terror Timeline. And he's done a lot of research into the war games too. And really, to summarize, some of these war games, but there were different kinds, but a number of them were involving NORAD and the FAA. And they had a number of different scenarios that were involved, all planned on the morning of 9/11. One of these scenarios was that there was an attack by Russia, and there had to be some kind of U.S. response. Another scenario was some other kind of operation in relation to another operation related to Russia and China. Another scenario was, amazingly, a kind of a global Armageddon in which a U.S. response was gauged. And several other scenarios like this. There were also a number of other exercises, but, I mean, no need to go into too much detail. What is most interesting is that these all intersected on the morning of 9/11, and it's very difficult to see how these kind of exercises could have been done on the morning of 9/11 without interfering with the ability of the national security apparatus to respond in a normal way to the events of 9/11. It seems pretty clear at face value that they would have created some kind of a dysfunction in that response. There's a lot of good reason to believe that they took away huge amounts of resources in terms of fighter craft and so on and so forth from military bases where they would normally have been waiting on alert. Instead, these aircraft were flown, for example, on the border of Alaska and other obscure places in order to participate in these exercises. Most perturbingly, Michael Rupert has got an on-the-record confirmation from a NORAD official. I can't remember the name. It was a named NORAD official who had actually testified before the 9/11 Commission. And what happened is that basically there was a statement made by Richard Myers, I believe it was, and that was quoted by Richard Clark, the former White House counterterrorism czar. And in his book Against All Enemies, and Richard Clark recounts this conversation on the morning of 9/11 with Richard Myers, and he's saying to Myers, you know, look, we've got this. What do we have to respond to what's happening? And Myers says, in this kind of nonchalant, indifferent way, well, you know, we're in the middle of this exercise right now, and he gave the name. It was I can't remember the exact name because some of them sound rather similar. But he gave the name of this operation, and he said, you know, we're doing it right now, so we don't have as much as we could have had. I'm working on it. I'll come back to you. And Richard Clark has this doubt in his book. So what Michael Rupert did, he went and checked this out. He got the name of the operation. He passed it by this NORAD official, who confirmed on the record that means that it's a code name for a live fly hijack exercise. In other words, Richard Myers, on the morning of 9/11, while there was hijackings going on, was telling Richard Clark that, I'm sorry, I can't help you because I'm engaged in a live fly hijack exercise on my own. So clearly, this is absolutely direct evidence from the horse's mouth that the very officials who were directly involved in the response on 9/11 were actually orchestrating a non-response in relation to military exercises, war games that were being conducted, including live fly exercises. In other words, using real aircraft. So what was going on? I mean, this really does raise big questions about the manner in which these events were pulled off.
Well, it's like I said, I think it's too weird to be coincidence that those just all these war games happened to be going on the same day that this actual attack occurred. But even so, having said that, couldn't Myers at that point have redirected, said, whoa, the war games are off, we have a real emergency, and why wasn't that done?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that the war games certainly caused confusion on that day. We've got other NIAID officials who've spoken out in different, they've been quoted in different reports, basically saying that on that day we were carrying out this exercise. Then suddenly we were told that there was a hijacking, and we asked the question, is this part of the exercise? And the answer came, no, this is real. So they had to switch off the exercise and actually get involved in a real response. Again, that itself raises a lot of interesting issues about the kind of exercise that was being carried out and the kind of scenarios that it would have included, because these exercises are very specific. They have very planned and clear trajectories about, you know, what you're supposed to be dealing with. Why would they have asked that about a hijacking, whether this was part of the exercise, unless it was a possibility that the hijacking was written into the script of the exercise? So this raises a lot of things about advanced warning, about how much was known, how long these things were planned for. We know for a fact that Department of Defense officials knew something was going to happen on 9/11. There was a Newsweek article which came out about 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks. And actually, they repeated the same thing. They confirmed the same report about a month later. But basically, what they said was that on 10th September 2001, senior Pentagon officials canceled their travel plans for the next day over security concerns. Now, if the Department of Defense knew that something was going to happen in 9/11, then why did they only take measures to protect themselves by canceling their travel plans, and they didn't do anything for the wider public? More than that, they allowed these multiple war games on the morning of 9/11 to take place when they knew that there was a serious security issue in relation to air travel. This is absolutely, you know, flabbergasting, and it demonstrates clearly that people at the top not only had very precise advanced warning about the attacks, that they had the capacity, they had the ability to ensure that nothing would happen. But these pre-planned exercises, if there was real sincerity on the part of government officials to actually protect the American public, they would have cancelled those exercises and ensured that the national security system was fully functioning, fully operating, in order to protect the American people. That didn't happen on 9/11. They didn't do it, and they had every opportunity on that morning to take measures, even in the midst of the crisis. And like you said, Robert, why did Myers not just carry on with the exercise when he could have said, no, you're right, we've got to do something, I'm going to stop, cancel the exercise? Instead, he used it as an excuse to say, I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Yeah, it's sort of admitting to negligence to maybe cover up something worse. You know, we're running out of time here. I've got so many more questions for you, so maybe another show. But if we could wrap up here, I would like to maybe you just go over some suggestions for us, what we can do. I mean, we're trying to spread the word and get people to realize that the official story is a joke. So what are your suggestions as far as people getting more involved in bringing the truth out about this?
Well, I think it really is, it's a difficult thing. I mean, in terms of a person-to-person, you know, I mean, when you're dealing with these kind of things, it's very easy to feel completely overwhelmed. You know, what can I do against this, you know, this huge bureaucracy and apparatus of lies and deception with so much financing and so much, you know, military police state how can we counter this as individuals and as communities? We're not financed and armed in the same way at all. But I think it really is about undercutting the basis of popular support for these people. I mean, I don't think these people really have that popular support in any meaningful way. But I think that what is needed is a real change in consciousness amongst people, and this does take time. I mean, it takes a lot of time to get people to understand these kind of things. But I mean, for me, the way it is really kind of trying to make people realize that there are difficulties with what the government is being saying about 9/11, and that means not necessarily coming out and saying that the government did it or they definitely knew. Because sometimes getting people to that point is, and trying to get them to accept that conclusion is really too much for people to take. You really need to take people through a process where they can first start recognizing that, wait a minute, the government hasn't been honest with us about this. Now, that can be explained by a number of things when you don't know that much. So you can keep an open mind and you can say, well, look, let's explore these things. Why are they lying about this? Let's have a look at these things. And, you know, different people will be susceptible to different ways of looking at it. Some people are interested in the intelligence failure, you know, and some people are more interested in what happened on the day. Other people are interested in the fact that Al-Qaeda has functioned as a kind of covert operations tool for many. It really does depend, you know, and how you look at it. I mean, a lot of people would be shocked if they realized that, you know, that Al-Qaeda has actually been given finances and military aid by the Pentagon, by NATO, in relation to the Balkans. It really doesn't make any sense. But it really depends who your audience is and who you're talking to. Once you get people to think about these things and ask questions, often they go away, and these things, you know, you can't escape them. They do eventually make you realize that something is wrong. And you just have to give people the information, I think, give people the facts, and you will see that their consciousness will start to change. Most people want to know the truth. They just don't have any information available. That is why the government is consistently trying to cover up these kind of things, because they know that if these facts get out, people will start to turn against the government. The tide will turn. So really, it's just, I really think it's a matter of making the information available to people.
Okay, we got to wrap up here, Nafiz.
Sure.
We're out of time. I want to say thank you so much for being with us. The website again?
Website is www.globalresearch.org.
Okay, and the book, The War on Truth, 9/11, Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism, Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Robert. Cheers.
Okay, bye now. All right, we got to wrap up here on Out the Rabbit Hole. I want to remind you again that the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. Next week on Out the Rabbit Hole, I will have Lamar Waldron. We'll be discussing his book, Ultimate Sacrifice, actually some new revelations about the JFK assassination. So that's going to be good stuff. In 2 weeks, I'm going to have Wayne Kramer. So I'm going to leave you with some music from him here before we turn it over to the Children's Hour with Deanne. It's KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Robert Larson. I'll be talking to you next week.